Well, good morning, everyone. Good morning. Welcome to the Board of Public Works. Earlier this morning, I received a thorough briefing from state health officials regarding our coordinated response to the coronavirus outbreak, which has become a major public health crisis in China. And our administration's first and most important priority is keeping Marylanders safe. And we want our citizens to know that all levels of government are working together to respond to threats to public health. And while there have been no confirmed cases of coronavirus here in Maryland, one individual has met the criteria for testing by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Now, this individual is in good condition and remains in isolation pending the results of testing. At my direction, the state is taking every precaution to prepare and mobilize whatever resources are necessary to address the coronavirus. And state health officials are working with hospitals and health departments all across the state to activate an aggressive and collaborative response. Our state government team is in close communication with federal officials and will continue to remain so on an ongoing basis. We are in communication with state and federal officials at BWI Airport to implement protocol for incoming flights and to ensure that all travelers are appropriately informed. Maryland is fortunate to have some of the top health research facilities in the world, and I am confident in our state's ability to respond to any potential cases of the virus. I also expect that we will be a leader in developing treatments and perhaps even a vaccine to respond to this crisis. So while there is no need for immediate concern, we are taking this issue very seriously, and we encourage Marylanders to stay informed by visiting health.maryland.gov/coronavirus to follow all of the latest updates. And we will continue to provide information as it becomes available and as the situation develops. Now, on a totally different topic, I want to move on to an issue that Comptroller Francho has been passionately working on for many years. That is Maryland's return to the tradition of starting schools after Labor Day, which has the strong support of an overwhelming majority of Marylanders. After many years of public outcry, in 2013, the year before I was elected, the legislature voted 170-7 to pass legislation which mandated a state commission to study returning school dates to the traditional after Labor Day start. And the previous governor signed this bill into law and appointed a legislatively mandated commission that included members of the Maryland State Senate, members of the House of Delegates, the state superintendent of schools, representatives of local school systems, including local teachers, representatives of the teachers' union, parents, students, and members of the small business community. This legislatively mandated commission held hearings, obtained expert testimony, and spent more than a year studying and debating this issue in great detail before reaching their final determination in May of 2014, when the commission voted 12-3 in favor of returning to a universal school start date after Labor Day. A few months later, just 60 days before I was elected, in September of 2014, the former governor, Martin O'Malley, signed Comptroller Francho's petition right here during a Board of Public Works meeting supporting school after Labor Day. He then ran out of time on his term and was unable to follow through on his commitment to implement it. So after the legislative session began in January of 2015, I was inaugurated, and I made the decision to allow the legislature the opportunity to finalize the implementation of their own 2013 proposal. Because of undue pressure from a small group of political operatives and special interest groups, the legislature failed to implement the overwhelming recommendation of their own commission. And in 2016, after the repeated failure of the legislature to follow through on their own commitment, on the vote of their mandated commission, and on the overwhelming majority, the will of the overwhelming majority of citizens, I signed the executive order to do what the legislature, the previous governor, and nearly everyone in the state wanted us to do. So beginning with the 2017-18 school year, Maryland Public Schools finally went back to starting classes after Labor Day. The number of instructional days for students remained exactly the same at 180 days. In the event of too many snow or emergency days, local boards of education had the flexibility to increase the length of the school year by 5 additional days without the approval of the state board. Local school systems had the full ability to set their own calendar. And we've taken a lot of actions over the past 5 years. But I can't think of a single one that has more widespread, overwhelming, and enthusiastic support all across the state than this one. So after 2 years of it working very well, and after the 2018 election was completed, last year, in 2019, special interests snuck a bill in, and legislators reversed themselves again and ignored the people once again by reversing this common sense action with a misguided piece of legislation, which has the potential to cause mass confusion in the fall and in the years ahead, with the potential for 24 different start dates over several weeks. And so today I am introducing the Universal School Start Act of 2020, which will repeal the legislature's 2019 misguided bill and return our state to what the citizens actually want and have been demanding for many, many years, and that is the return to the school start date after Labor Day. With that, I'll turn it over to any opening remarks.
Well, Governor, I didn't think I had any opening remarks.
You probably do now. Good.
But now I do.
I'm glad I could spur some.
I think many of the facts that you've cited are correct. There was. I'm glad to know that there's some legislative mandates, by the way, that you're supportive of. There was a study pursuant to legislation, and it came out with a recommendation. That is absolutely true. And you take different polls at different points in time, but there's no doubt that there's a large portion of people who think, including people who have no connection to the public schools, who think schools should start earlier, and then there are others who believe that they should start at the traditional time after Labor Day. I did look through the studies, and by the way, I'm not sure that they actually looked into the question of cost to the families, which is something that my family knows quite well. But that's one of the issues. But yes, there was a study. It then went to the legislature, the legislature elected by the people, and they thought that it was not the way to go. What concerned a lot of us who argued with you at the time was the question of whether a governor, like a president, through fiat, through executive order, ought to override the elected school boards at the local level and the state legislature elected across the state. And I think not. You and the comptroller believe that you should have that authority.
If the comptroller and I, 80% of the people in the state.
Now, both you were reelected and the legislature elected, and if you are proposing legislation, it seemed to me that that's what I argued at the time was the appropriate role, propose legislation and let the elected representative, the first branch of government, vote on it.
That's what I just did today.
Yes, mm-hmm. And I think that, and let's not try to govern by fiat and executive order.
I just think it's about time that the legislature not continue to ignore the will of the people, and that's why we're introducing a bill today.
Let me just point out, you were elected in the same election as the legislature. They ran. It was an issue. It's an issue for public discussion and decision-making.
Let me just point out that they refused to do anything before the election. They snuck it in after the election because they knew it was going to be very unpopular. I turn it over to Mr. Comptroller.
Thank you, Governor and Madam Treasurer. This past Monday marked the official start of the year's tax filing season. Not everybody's favorite holiday, as I will note.
It's kind of like Christmas.
Yeah. So over the last several months, many of the dedicated employees in my agency have worked hard to ensure that we have an efficient and effective tax season. Last year, we processed more than 3.1 million tax returns and disbursed $3 billion, that's B as in boy, $3 billion in refunds to 2.4 million Maryland families under three business days upon receiving their tax refund request and putting their money back in their bank account. And this happens in a very concentrated period of the next 6 weeks. This is not something that's dragged out until April 15th. That's when the governor and I and the treasurer submit our tax returns. No, sorry, I shouldn't accuse everybody. But people that owe money wait until the last possible moment, April 15th. But people that are owed refunds or traditionally get them, they are pouring in right now. Obviously, it's electronically done. And I'm very proud of the employees for being able to maintain the system that we have that we're in the process of replacing, thanks to the governor and the legislature, but that's going to take a number of years to phase in. We're currently using the same system they used 20 years ago, and it's a marvel to see the employees be able to get, knock on wood, a successful tax season. I'm proud of these figures, Governor. Because so many Maryland families depend on tax refunds, it remains a top priority for us that we process the returns. And we're going to get, over the next month or so, get them out accurately and as fast as possible, the refunds. Every single employee of the agency is on notice that customer service is the top priority. I often remind people in the state that the comptroller's office is not the IRS. When you call our 1-800-MD-TAXES taxpayer hotline, you'll get a live, friendly, knowledgeable professional on the line, usually under 60 seconds. 800,000 phone calls a year. Not easy. How do we do that? We set up remote call centers all over the state, trained professionals who help us do this kind of customer service. So if you're experiencing financial troubles and can't pay off a tax liability, which we hear often, we'll work with you. We'll put you on a payment plan that you can live with. But you've got to communicate with us. I call it the three R's, our system. Respect the taxpayer, respond to the taxpayer, get results for the taxpayer. And just finally, let me mention tax fraud and identity theft, because as everyone knows, this is a problem that continues to impact our communities. It's become the norm, not the exception, to meet people out in the hustings who have been victimized by the theft of their financial identity. And there are brazen tactics that are used. They send us thousands, tens of thousands of fraudulent tax refund requests. This month alone, we've blocked $134,000 in fraudulent refunds in the last 2 days. Thank God for algorithms and filters, because we're able to protect the citizens as well as get speedy refunds back. So we're going to continue to do that, and I appreciate the opportunity to just mention two issues. One, I want to praise Governor Hogan for the resolution of this paving issue on the Chesapeake Bay Bridge. Because of his actions and his agency actions, Mr. Slater, I see you there, and I know Mr. Ports never thinks I say anything nice about him, but he's, you know, they have accelerated this paving project significantly. And I want to applaud the governor for stepping on the gas so that Marylanders, commuters, are going to be not spending all summer stepping on their brake. Yeah, this is a big deal, and it is not easy to galvanize the bureaucracy, which I know is you're in charge of, Governor, but it's not easy when it's a difficult ask. And hats off to you. And then thank you again for mentioning my favorite subject, school after Labor Day. The treasurer mentioned that it's costly for working families to have an extra week or 2 weeks of child care during the summer by mandating that schools start after Labor Day. 75% or 80% of Marylanders support starting school after Labor Day. The major reason they give is that the current school calendars don't make any sense to them. Every time they turn around in January, February, March, there's some ad hoc half day off or a full day off, and they inexplicably arrive without any warning generally. And you talk about a penalty that working families in Maryland pay for this. I'm not talking about wealthy families. Wealthy families can take care of this. But working families during the school year, this plethora of inexplicable days off and half days off, they either have to take their kid to work with them.
Good idea.
Or they have to stay home, take a vacation day. Or if they have to pay through the year for things they, child care for a day that they can't afford. So I strongly support the citizens of the state who have overwhelmingly said the current school calendars don't make any sense to them. And this idea that we have to stand in the doorway and reward special interests that are able to have inordinate power at the local level and can impose their school calendars in a willy-nilly ad hoc way, I think it's got to end. And the other argument, of course, is, oh, Mr. Comptroller, you're not in favor of the kids. You're in favor of small businesses. Excuse me. Who generates the tax revenue to pay for K through 12 education? It's the small businesses of the state. So why do we burden working families, most of all, but also burden businesses with this uncertain, unpredictable, weird system we have where we're constantly moving the start date of schools around earlier and earlier in August. Pretty soon it'll be July. And we're doing it for the benefit of several small number of people that have way too much authority, and they're abusing that authority at the local level. And so I didn't realize the governor was going to do this, but I think it's a darn good idea. And next time you're driving by your local elementary or middle or high school and you see that sign out in front that says half day off, think of people that don't have a lot of resources and how they have to scramble to take care of that. And if you like small businesses at all, understand the unpredictability that they have in their business plans with all of this crazy hodgepodge of start dates. So I didn't mean to get going on that. He just brought it up, and thank you for doing that, Governor. Madam Treasurer, I think there's an honest policy difference between people that want longer school year, more attendance by kids. I can understand that, but that's not this issue.
Yeah, I mean, great. We've been talking about it for 10 years. We'll have another 67 days to argue with the legislature about it. So,
by the way,
now we get to move on with our agenda.
There's no school system in the state that doesn't publish the calendars a year ahead of time.
The good news is they all go to school for 180 days, and it's just a question of whether you want to have, you know, 10 or 13 days off in the middle of the year, or whether you want to have a...
Could I just applaud the eight or so counties that have, despite the pressure at the local level from a small number of people, have been able to nonetheless schedule their start dates?
Most students are still going to be going to school after Labor Day, in spite of the craziness.
Yeah, no, so hats off to the local officials, but...
Because of the hundreds of people that showed up at the school board meetings. But let's move on to the work of the Board of Public Works this morning and start with the Secretary's agenda.
Good morning, Governor, Madam Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller. There are 13 items on the Secretary's agenda and 4 reports of emergency procurement. Item 11 and emergency procurement report A2 have been revised. I'm happy to assist with answering any questions.
Questions on the Secretary's agenda?
Move approval unless the Treasurer has something. Madam Treasurer?
No, I don't.
Second.
I'm sorry.
Nothing on the Secretary's agenda. Move on to DNR real property. I understand we have, Madam Secretary, some special guests here with us today. We're going to pause while we get some of them in the room, I think. Unless you want to kind of give us your agenda while they're coming in, and then we'll move into that.
Yeah. Good morning, Governor, Madam Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller. For the record, Jeannie Hadaway Riccio with the Department of Natural Resources. And thank you for the opportunity to highlight our Maryland Climate Leadership Academy today. DNR's goal in the Leadership Academy is to equip leaders and decision makers and Maryland's workforce with the skills that they need to be ready to meet the challenges of climate change, flooding, and increasing severe weather. So in 2018, we launched the nation's first state-sponsored institution, and that institution provides continuing education and executive training specifically designed for state and local government officials, for infrastructure executives, and for business leaders. We certainly are not doing it alone. We partner with many organizations, including the Association of Climate Change Officers, the Maryland Department of the Environment, and I'd like to acknowledge that Secretary Grumbles is here today. And also I want to highlight Madam Treasurer as a partner. She is on our advisory council board for the Leadership Academy. And Governor Hogan, I wanted to take a moment to thank you for your leadership on these issues and for the funding that you have provided for DNR's Coastal Resiliency Program, which is a first-of-its-kind grant program. You included over $4 million in the budget for that this year. You also fully funded the Chesapeake and Atlantic Coastal Based Trust Fund, which provides funding for resiliency projects. And you also funded $2 million for the Ocean City Beach Replenishment and Hurricane Protection Program, which will provide really important resiliency on our Atlantic coastline. So since November 2018, when we launched the Academy, we've trained more than 450 professionals through 6 cohorts. And among those participants are 40 who have joined us here today. The 40 individuals that are here with us today actually went the extra mile. They completed all of the exams and all of the electives so that they could become certified climate change professionals. And it is that accomplishment that we are honoring today. So, again, thank you, Governor, Madam Treasurer, and Mr. Comptroller, for your support and for your willingness to recognize the commitment of Maryland's first class of certified climate change professionals.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much, Madam Secretary. We're really proud of the climate change the Climate Leadership Academy that we launched back in May of 2018. It's the nation's first state-sponsored climate change training institute. I want to thank you and Secretary Grumbles and all the folks that were involved. I want to thank the Treasurer for her leadership. And I think let's all give congratulations to the team here. I don't know how we can fit this entire group in a photo. But if it's possible, can we try to squeeze them up here to get a picture with us to congratulate them?
Let's try to do that.
Governor, I can't help noticing all the certificates, too.
There's a lot of certificates.
Congratulate you.
Congratulations.
Come on this side.
Wow.
Maybe bring 400.
It looks like we're recording.
Congratulations. I think somebody miscounted it.
You know why that glance on that.
Ladies back behind the man. No wider than that. Ladies back next to the Maryland flag. One to two. Yeah. If I can have you switch spots with the blonde haired lady in front of me, that'd be great. Thank you. Ma'am, over near the flag more. Blonde over near the flag more.
You can come right here. You can come right here with me if you want.
Okay, let's see all those beautiful faces right here. Thank you very much.
Congratulations, everyone. Thank you.
Secretaries and the committee and everything, Dan Krieger has been guiding the development of your academy and doing it.
Nice work, Dan.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Thank you all very much.
I'd like to just add one word about another aspect of the academy. Secretary Hadaway Riccio's predecessor, Mark Belton, was Secretary of Natural Resources when we started up the Academy, as you know. He now is administrator of Charles County. And they just went out to the bond market for the general obligation bond, Charles County. And one of the major reasons they were given a AAA bond rating by Standard & Poor's was citing of their work in preparation for resilience, most particularly their strong participation in the academy. So it has a very significant impact on the environment, on government, and on the finances. Their AAA bond rating means their taxpayers have to pay less to build schools and other public facilities.
Absolutely.
And while we're on DNR, could I ask?
We are back to the DNR agenda now.
Could I ask the Secretary a question, which
sure.
is the white jacket, the white outfit you're wearing, is there an occasion today?
There is an occasion. As some know, thanks to Governor Hogan, 2020 was declared the year of the woman in the state of Maryland, and that is to coincide with all of the celebrations around the 100th anniversary of the 19th Amendment. And thank you for pointing that out, Madam Treasurer, and Governor Hogan, thank you for making it the Year of the Woman.
This is the day of celebration, one of many.
We're celebrating every day of the Year of the Woman.
Yes, as properly we should.
And every year should be the Year of the Woman, as far as I'm concerned.
Every year is the year. The suffragettes, when they were campaigning for the vote,
wore white.
Yes.
Very good. Any other questions on DNR?
Motion. Move approval.
Second. 3-0 on DNR. We're going to move on to the university system agenda.
Good morning. Joey Evans representing the University System of Maryland. We have 4 items on the agenda here to answer any questions.
Any questions on the university system?
Did I see a design bid build contract?
Yes, sir, you did.
You must have been imagining it.
Thank you.
Is that really a question?
No.
Any other questions? Is there a motion?
Move approval.
Second. 3-0.
Thank you.
I will move on to the Department of Transportation.
Good morning, Governor, Madam Treasurer.
By the way, welcome. It's hard to imagine because it seems like he's been here forever, but I believe this is our Secretary of Transportation's very first official meeting as the Secretary of Transportation. So welcome.
It is. Thank you. It is my pleasure to be here this morning. Good morning, Governor, Madam Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller. For the record, my name is Greg Slater. I am the Acting Secretary of Maryland Department of Transportation. The Maryland Department of Transportation is presenting 13 items today. We are withdrawing item 5, IT Mod. And I'd also like to highlight a few items on our agenda. We have two items directly related to the customer experience at BWI Marshall Airport. And we have another item on the DGS agenda that really helps us further our advancements for on-time performance in our transit services. In the fall of 2016, our core bus service performance was around 59.5%. And since we've launched Baltimore Link in June, that performance has grown tremendously. This past December, our core bus monthly average on-time performance had grown to 74%, a 14% increase. And in that same December, we had the highest weekly core bus on-time performance at 77 and our highest day ever at 82% on-time performance. So it's about using data and this technology to continue to build efficiencies in our system.
Well, thank you, Secretary Slater. I want to congratulate our administrator, Kevin Quinn, on improving. That's quite an improvement on up to 79%. But you know me, I'm never satisfied, so I'm looking forward to seeing continued improvements until we get to 100%. Let's start with 82 every day instead of the one day. But really want to congratulate you on all of your efforts to make those pretty substantial improvements. So thank you. Any other questions on the transportation agenda?
Yes, I want to join the praise of the new, Secretary of Transportation. Greg Slater reminds me a lot of a legendary predecessor that he had, John Pecari, who was just universally recognized by folks on both sides of the aisle as just a tremendous advocate for rational civil discussion. And that's a pretty rare company, and I associate Mr. Slater with best values of John Pecari. And congratulations, Governor, because I think Greg Slater is going to do well for the state and for your administration.
Well, thank you. I feel the same way, but, you know, John Pecari was a friend of mine going back to his days of Prince George's County. And I just don't want Mr. Slater to get his head blown up in his first week. But I agree, he's going to do a terrific job, so thank you for saying that.
Governor, could I, as so often, agree with the comptroller and you and say that we have great hopes for the secretary and all he's done since he's become secretary in terms of all the work of reaching out throughout the state as well as getting the department running in a civil and collegial way. I think it's a great step forward.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much.
So,
now you're grilled. But you have some tough questions for him.
Item one.
Yes, exactly. Item one.
Yeah, so this is a lease and concession contract, Mr. Secretary, for the design, development, and financing, construction, management, and maintenance of two gas station and convenience locations within the BWI Marshall complex. I guess my concern is that how did we end up after a competitive bid RFP, how did we end up with a single bid contract to an out-of-state developer?
Good morning. We have Executive Director for Maryland Aviation, Ricky Smith, as well as our Superstar Director of Commercial Development, Jiminy Erskine.
Good morning, Governor, Treasurer, Matter Controller. The airport spent a number of years trying to figure out ways to expand our non-airline-related revenue base. And so we have a five-acre lot that's on Amtrak Way. It's adjacent to the Amtrak station across from Northrop Grumman, where we have hundreds of employees who look for gas station-related services. And it's also close to our rental car facility, where we also have customers that are in dire need of gas station facilities. So we decided to launch a procurement to entice a developer to come in and offer gas station services as well as convenient food services at that location. So during the procurement, we initially did a survey to try to get a feel for what the marketplace would want in order to find this as an attractive procurement. And so in that survey, the feedback we got was one, if I can back up, we also have another gas station on the north side of the airport. That lease is expiring, and so we had both considerations that we had to deal with. And so the feedback we got from the survey was that the marketplace would rather have the two combined as one solicitation because they didn't want the competition, and also the economies of scale would make it a more attractive opportunity for them. And so when we put it out on the street, we actually got three responders. One of the responders modified its financial condition, its financial offer to include a condition which violated the procurement requirements in the RFP, and so that firm was disqualified. The other one did not offer a financial proposal.
The financial offer that they had was actually not sufficient, so it didn't fulfill the mandatory requirements of the RFP.
And so we were down to just one. The one firm that we are recommending is the firm that currently operates the gas station, the BWI gas station, on the north side of the airport. This firm also operates gas stations across the country at airports. They specialize in airport-related gas station developments. And so that's how we came down to one. Our preference.
My understanding is, and correct me if I'm wrong, this is a very unique situation, because unlike a typical state procurement, we're dealing with federal law that required this, the airport concession disadvantaged business enterprise, ACDBE, participation.
Correct.
Of 25%.
Correct. So all airports.
Which is only applies to these airports, right?
That's correct.
The bid went out. I think maybe Royal Farms and Wawa both were interested. And as soon as they said they had to comply with this federal, they both dropped.
Okay, including
and
Sheets
only
as
one,
well. Yes.
Who only does airports.
That's correct.
It's the only bidder, because no one else can meet that requirement.
That's correct.
So it has nothing to do with state procurement or our bid process. It's federal law.
Right. Their structure just doesn't allow for participation in the airport concessions disadvantage environment.
No, that would explain why 11 of the 14 that were interested did not bid.
Yeah.
But I guess my question is, was that identified when you first went out and surveyed the group?
So that was not identified as an issue when we did the survey, but after we did the procurement, we did follow up with a couple firms, and they identified the ACDBE requirement as a an issue that they just could not
It's a pretty aggressive goal, but it seems to be hard for any, there's not very many companies that can comply, I guess.
So the 25% goal is the goal that's on the existing gas station contract that we have, and so we thought it would be attainable.
And that's so the incumbent protection.
Steal my lines. No, I guess my question, Mr. Administrator, is did you give any consideration after the two of the three bids were ruled unresponsive and you ended up with the incumbent with the single bid contract that's before us, did you give any consideration to rebidding this and perhaps splitting it into, rather than both of them together, separately? And try to produce some competition.
So we did give that consideration. There were two factors. One, the marketplace had already told us that combining the two would make it most attractive. Secondly, we have an existing procurement. We have an existing contract, a lease, with the gas station company on the north side of the airport that is expiring. As a matter of fact, I believe it's on a month-to-month now. And so we needed to complete the procurement in time to satisfy that contract.
Okay, but this is a fairly lucrative contract because, and it's important to the state, we get 5.75% of the gross sales goes to the state.
So how long are these leases going to be in this obviously attractive, high-traffic, busy locations? How long are the leases for?
So there are two terms. The term for the new location, the Amtrak location, is 25 years. The term for the existing location on the north side is 10 years because the airport's expansion plans extends the terminal into that area, and so we want to have the flexibility to end that contract, get out of that contract to support the expansion.
When you issued it, what were your projections or assumptions about the long-term profits?
Well, going into the procurement, we didn't necessarily have a...
How much do you get now on the one northern?
On the existing gas station, what's our revenue now?
Not off the top of my head,
yeah,
but...
We don't have it off the top of our head. I think it's... I don't know the number I'm talking about.
Can I ask you this?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
There were 14 potential bidders. 11 of them just dropped out right away because they said we're not doing this federal law.
Correct.
The other ones tried to bid and couldn't comply. How far off were the bids? The only bidder that could meet the federal, was that financially, was that a much different bid from the ones who couldn't comply?
Well, the ones that submitted a bid and Rural Farms were one of these bidders, because they conditioned their proposal, we were counting fuel sales and non-fuel sales, and that was part of the RFP. That was the requirement. And so they conditioned it to say, you know, a lot of large companies don't want to give up their fuel sales. So that was one of the concerns that we had, that, you know, we're not actually maximizing the revenue to the state.
Well, my point is, if we somehow change the federal law, is it going to dramatically change the financial revenues to the state by saying we can get other bidders instead of having a one non-bid, no competition contract with somebody that's the incumbent?
Yeah, if the FAA regulation didn't stipulate the 25%, then yeah, I mean that would certainly open it up.
Maybe that's what we should work on.
Other airports, do any of these firms, the 11 firms, or the other three, not have facilities at airports?
Not every airport has this kind of development. I did a similar development in my previous life in Cleveland. We didn't get a lot of responses to that as well because of the federal requirement, one. Also, this company just seems to specialize in creating relationships with the airport community to drive business at its locations.
I really don't. I mean, I use the train station a lot in the airport. It is a perfect location for a gas station.
Couldn't you also get around that issue by surplusing the property and realizing the value, you know, so you would get the benefit of all that revenue and it wouldn't be part of the airport concession anymore?
So there's a we're talking a lot about the FAA. So the FAA requires that airports maximize revenues on its properties. So if it's been determined that this is the best approach to maximizing revenues on the airport as opposed to just selling off the property.
Okay.
So I have a lot of confidence in the airport's leadership. Thank you for running a very successful state-owned airport.
Breaking records every month.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no. It's
number one airport in the region.
That is correct.
And they also have good customer service. So thank you, guys.
Keep beating the heck out of Dulles. I like that.
Yeah, we are winning Dulles. Yeah.
Let me ask you a question, though, Mr. Administrator. Was there, when you put this out to bid, was it part of the bid RFP that they had to do the airport concession disadvantaged business enterprise participation program?
So
that was in the contract.
So prior to putting the RFP on the street, we first have to get the FAA to approve the procurement document. And yes, this was included in that solicitation document.
Okay, so not to be overly candid, but even though I don't like the single bid contracts given to incumbents, I'm going to vote for this. But part of it's that you guys are apparently on at all hands on deck with this coronavirus, and you have enough things to deal with up there. That's my basic
rationale, not that it makes any sense to anybody, but that's my view right now. But if you could suggest some ways for us to avoid this particular federal program, whatever it is, that seems to cut down on the ability to have competition, I would be grateful. And if you could also, I met recently with Senator Clarence Lamb and Councilwoman Deb Jung, who live in the airplane noise path, and this is becoming an insufferable, completely, utterly unacceptable situation west of the airport, where these planes are coming in. Apparently Amazon has bought a whole bunch of junky old planes that make tremendous amounts of noise and are very polluting, and they're bringing them in at 2, 3, and 4 a.m. at altitudes where you can literally read the Amazon name on the plane. And so I understand that this is a federal situation and that you guys don't have a lot of clout, but something's going to have to happen. So, you just cannot submit people to jumping out of their beds at 3 in the morning. Oh, morning after morning after morning. It's not fair. And Amazon is now double FedEx and UPS as far as flights.
So what can you do? Anything?
So actually, this is to some degree an opportunity to talk about how communities can come together and address an issue like this. We know the governor's actions, compelling the attorney general's office to file a suit. Those are still working their way.
I didn't realize that.
The court system, yes, both an administrative petition and a suit was filed on behalf of the governor's request. We also worked with affected communities to form the BWI roundtable. These were participants that were appointed by elected officials representing those districts, and so the roundtable over a period of about a year working with the airport, Southwest Airlines, and other industry representatives. We've recommended to the FAA changes to the flight path to correct that issue, and so we have one recommendation that represents the entire affected community, and so the FAA has agreed to consider that until March. They have a special process they're going to go through, and so sometime around March, they should review that recommendation and get back to us on whether or not they're going to make modifications.
Good.
It's one of the best processes that we've seen in this country in terms of dealing with the FAA's flight changes.
Could you just do a favor for me,
yes,
though? Can you, just kidding, if you could draft a letter that I could sign to Amazon, to Jeff Bezos, and if it's true that they're using old, cheap airplanes, which I assume Amazon is, because they're always cutting corners, and they're geniuses at that, but these old, loud, polluting airplanes are coming into greater use at just the wrong time on this issue. And if you could take a look at whether, in fact, they are old and noisy and cheap, and draft a letter that makes some sense, because I'm not an expert on this, for upgrading the planes and reducing the noise, I'd happy to distribute it to the treasurer and the governor, too. But something has to happen here. Right now, I don't sense that there's going to be any logjam breakthrough.
So there's also a federally authorized process for mitigating the impact of aircraft noise. It's called a Part 150 study. Our plan is to engage a new Part 150 study once we get some resolution on the flight path changes that have occurred. That's the vehicle that we use to modify, if necessary, an Amazon, for example, flight behavior.
Okay, but if you can call Senator Lamb for me and Councilwoman Deb Jung, they were pretty hot under the collar when they came into my office.
We will follow up with them.
Desperate, frankly.
I will.
So, good luck.
Yes, sir.
Thank you for that.
Thank you.
Could you just keep us informed as things develop at the FAA? And also, I'd appreciate your views. I appreciate what the comptroller said and the idea of a letter, but the people at the airport, your staff, must have some knowledge of what Amazon and particularly Amazon, but the other, not the scheduled airlines, but the others are doing, what they're using, when they're coming in. I'd appreciate hearing that from you, too.
So we're trying to balance two priorities here. One,
absolutely,
it's important to this community that we have the service that an Amazon brings, for example. I mean, there are almost 1,200 jobs as a result of their buildup at BWI Marshall, and I think that's important to a lot of people. But we want them to do that in a way that minimizes the impact of aircraft noise, and there's a process for doing that. There's a federally mandated process for doing that, and we are working that process. We don't certify aircraft. That's an FAA requirement, and some people might question how well they do that, but that's their priority. We don't dictate what hours an airline or a freight airline can fly their aircraft. That's the FAA's discretion. That's their discretion. However, when they are violating the flight paths that have been approved by the FAA, and we get complaints, we can follow up with them, and we can take whatever actions we have available to us to try to change their behavior.
So if you could keep us informed on what you're doing. And one other question, EV, you mentioned gas, so obviously yes. EV charging, will they be at those facilities, and also what's happening at the airport and the Amtrak station,
yes.
Amtrak parking?
We included in the solicitation that they had to have EV stations at both locations.
Both locations will have EV stations.
How much? How many?
How many?
I think there were 11 at one location and 7 at one location.
Okay, and how about at the garages?
We currently have.
I know you have some.
Six currently at the in the hourly garage. We're working with BG&E now to expand that in both our hourly garage and our daily garage. Because our customers are asking for it, we think it's the right thing to do, and so we're working very hard to expand the number of spaces that are EV charged.
Good. If you could just send us a number.
Sure.
Thanks.
And the treasurer just reminded me of a last issue. If you could keep us informed about the Wi-Fi contract that we're approving today at BWI, because apparently it's a company that hasn't done this. I'm not saying that's a disqualification. Just keep us informed about how it's implemented, please, unless I'm misstating the facts here.
Well, the company has done it before.
They have done it. Okay.
They're not specialized in airports, but part of the collection, there's nine companies that are part of the company. So AT&T is one, and they have other companies that are airport familiar or that have already been in airports before. It's just the main company, Slice, that they're based in New York. But they do Wi-Fi. They provide Wi-Fi products.
Okay. Well, keep us informed as to how it goes.
You're keeping us informed. We have some bullets, but I would appreciate hearing from you in more sort of narrative form what the privacy and security implications are and what you're doing to protect people's privacy.
So today we have the worst Wi-Fi service
this moment
in the country. For airports. It is very slow. It is unreliable.
I understand all that. I have a specific question.
So with respect to privacy, there are two levels here. So the company will know where cell phones are moving throughout the campus, but they will not know the personal information related to the owner of the cell phone. That's important to us because it allows us to understand how many people are using restrooms, for example, and when they're using them, or how many people are in and out of certain amenities at the airport. We don't have to know the personal information. We just need to know the number
of
people.
So you know everywhere I am and what I'm doing, you just don't know my name.
So we know how many people, for example, are using certain restrooms in the airport. We know that today under the existing Wi-Fi service. Okay. This service will continue that. The second level is if you opt into a tier two level, then then the provider will also know other information related to you. So, for example, today when I walk in the airport, I have an app on my phone called Foursquare, right? And so if I walk past O'Bricky's, I'll get an alert on my phone about O'Bricky's, right? Someone writing a comment saying, I just took a seat in O'Bricky's, this place is amazing, right? Or O'Bricky's is not full, so this is a good time to come there. If you subscribe to this tier two level, only if you subscribe, will the provider have access to that kind of information to send you those alerts, right? So you have to grant permission for the provider to have that kind of access.
Well, I would appreciate it, as I said, if you could, when you're sending this other information, send us that.
Okay.
In narrative, not just bullets.
Okay.
You can explain it a little. I know people sign up. We do. I mean, Safeway knows everything I eat. You know, I get that. I chose to do that. It may not have been wise. But just to explain it that way.
Okay.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other questions on transportation? Second. 3-0. Move on to Department of General Services.
Good morning, Governor, Madam Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller. For the record, I'm Ellington Churchill, Secretary of the Department of General Services. Today we are presenting 49 items for your consideration, including supplemental item 49. We are withdrawing item 29 and 48. I will also note or highlight that there is $21 million in terms of funding for medical campuses within our agenda for today. And we have representatives available to answer questions you may have at this time.
I see we have Dr. Mohan Santha, President of, and CEO of OMS, and we also have the Chairman of the Capital Region, my friend, the good Judge Alex Williams is here as well, answering questions. Other questions, Mr. Consular, Madam Treasurer?
I have a question on item 13.
Okay, item 13.
Item 13 concerning the Central Business Partnership.
Yes.
I don't believe my grants administrator is here, but maybe I can answer your
No, I just wanted to applaud the governor for granting $1 million in loan to the Central Baltimore Partnership for a number of capital investments in various projects in the Station North Arts District. Among the beneficiaries of this state investment are Made in Baltimore, which I've had the privilege of visiting and touring, Young Audiences and Code in the Schools, North Avenue Market in Baltimore Improv Group. I know someone from days gone by, Ellen James, is involved in this. If she's here, I'd love to have her just come up and tell us what impact this is going to have. If she isn't, I'll just stand in her
they
place.
They may be out in the hall or in transition into the room.
Okay. Well, I'll defer on that, but she's obviously someone who has had a big role in helping organizations and neighborhoods in the heart of Baltimore, and frankly, all around the state. So hats off to your administration for giving them some much-needed support.
It's a great project. I want to, again, echo the comptroller. With Ellen James particularly, but even without Ms. James, this is a great example of good development, public-private excellence.
Thanks. Any other questions?
And you mentioned that the OMS leadership are here. Please keep us in the loop on the new hospital over in Prince George's. Not everybody is building new acute care hospitals these days, but obviously something is needed in that area. And to the extent it's on time and on budget, that would be really good.
Very good. Any other questions?
Yeah, I have a question, Governor, on 26, the travel service.
Item 26.
Item 26, Joseph Consoli.
Is there someone? I just don't understand why there were more bidders. I'm just curious. It seems to me a service that's, there are a lot of people in the business.
What is item 26?
Item 26 has to do with the travel services for state agencies.
If not, somebody can come back. I mean, we need a contract. I'm not
We can address your question as a follow-up today concerning our
competition. I mean, it just seems strange that there isn't one company.
Okay. Any other questions?
Incumbent.
I think Jeff is always walking to the microphone now.
Okay.
Morning, Governor.
Good morning.
Treasurer.
Good
and Comptroller. The question is, why not more competition?
Why not more competition? Yeah.
We've tried our best with that. We put it out there for as long as we could. There are some national contracts in Sourcewell, but they don't address the particular issues we have within our state and the particular needs we have with our contract. They aren't interested in – essentially what they're telling us is we've done a national contract. You can sign up to use that one or not, but we're not interested in detailing it or customizing it for the needs we have within the state.
And what sort of needs do we have that no one else has?
We have a lot. We're a one-stop shop, basically. We're able to call one contractor, in this case, the Globetrotter, the incumbent, and they are able to take care of our entire needs from travel to hotel to cars, and it just makes it a really nice service. Most of the others would do one or two of the three or four things we ask, but not all of them at the same time. So we'd end up having to have a subcontracting kind of situation throughout. And we just don't.
But we like subcontracting.
They're okay, but we've really had no real hiccups with this particular incumbent either. They've done a good job over the time they've been here. But I'm with you. I'd much rather see more than just the two. That's ideally what you want to have. I don't really know what else we can do to kind of solicit.
Do we actually make enough changes that it makes up for a $300,000 difference in? Wasn't that what the difference was?
Roughly. I don't remember the exact numbers, but it was roughly that. It was a third more. The changes were...
The reason we were given was that they allow you to change your reservation for free instead of a charge.
That's not $300,000 worth. But there are a number of things. The board, the evaluation board, felt that the second proposer, while they were robust and they were trying to get into the business, they were trying to establish themselves as a good provider of travel, they just didn't seem to really get exactly what we needed. They seemed to be just falling short of what the RFP required in various stages. They answered our cure letters pretty well and gave us more information. We then asked more questions in the oral presentation. They answered them yet a little more detailed. But most of the time, the answers we got were, we're very confident we can handle what you have in the RFP. We don't see a problem with that. But they haven't handled anything nearly as large as our state travel contract. Also, there were other questions we had. They're going to allow designate about 8 employees to our account. But these employees would reside some in Asia, some in Europe, some in South America. And while our PII information for state employees would reside here in the cloud within the U.S., these other employees outside would have access to that information because we don't know who we're getting making our reservations. So there were a number of issues. And I believe I answered David Chasson the other day with that and gave him more detail in terms of what it was we were uncomfortable with. And in our minds, established the need for yet a more expensive contract.
Okay. Would you mind introducing yourself for the record, please, sir?
I'm sorry. My name is Joseph Masoli. I'm the administrator. I'm with the Department of Budget and Management Administrator for Travel and Fleet.
Thank you.
How are you doing with electric vehicles?
I think you're going to be very happy. It looks like we're going to be ordering in the next few days about 74 fully electric or plug-in hybrid vehicles under legislative section 42 of the budget. So that's looking really, really good. I also have not forgotten. I promised you last year I'd have a hybrid police vehicle for you to see, and it's coming. Ford's having some issues with getting the production, but they're going to send one to us. So.
Thank you.
Thank you. Questions?
Yes, I have a question on for Mr. Leahy on a different subject.
Yeah, thank you.
Good morning.
Yeah, so I noticed at the end of this, item 49,
yes, sir,
which is a $250 million 3-year with 2 renewal years contract. How can that possibly be something that you are procuring through this master contract as opposed to a traditional procurement?
Well, Mr. Comptroller, thank you for the question. As you, I believe, are aware, we at the governor's initiated a program that we're calling One Stop to digitize all of our state potential contact with citizens. And we've been in operation for a little over a year. In that year, we've created information on all 360 licenses and permits issued by the state, 14 different state agencies, and we are in the process now of digitizing a number of our applications and providing electronic means, which is considerably less expensive than using first-class mail, considerably less open human error. And this particular master contract involves the work that we're doing that is ongoing to now bring, over the next 5 months, another 31 licenses for another six agencies into the fold, and for the following period thereafter, till we get to all 360. The principal reason we've gone forward in this way was that the program has actually been more successful than originally anticipated. We have spent the money under the current contract, and that's why this was brought as a supplemental matter, because one of the bidders, it's my understanding, made an informal protest to the procurement people but did not file a formal protest with the Board of Contract Appeals. And because we are at the ceilings for the contract and we have committed to over 150 open projects that were either in flight or beginning, we thought it was important not to lose any additional time because of the potential savings and the efficiencies that this would bring to the state.
All right. Well, first of all, I'd just like to thank my colleagues because without their support and the board taking action, we would not be seeing these task
Absolutely,
orders.
Sir.
So this is a good thing. But this is an eye-popping amount, and I'm still a little dubious as to how exactly it was. I understand there was competition, so
yes.
I'm not objecting to that, but obviously, but maybe you can think about that down the road as to the amount of this. As I said, it's $150 million for 3 years with $250 million
Absolutely.
Annually. I'm not disputing that it's needed. I'm just suggesting that under the old system, we wouldn't have even seen it. Under the new system, it certainly caught my eye. And since you brought up the competition, item 4.1, is it 40IT is another one of these master contracts that we normally would not see. But this is a single bid contract. Why? I thought we were going to get rid of this using the master contracts.
Well,
that's only for $2.1 million.
But let me give me a moment and see what item this is.
Mr. Comptroller, which item under 40 there are? 4.1?
Sure.
4.1.
4.1 under
the last
40.
Item.
Yes. Mr. Comptroller, as I understand it, this is a matter for MDOT, and we are effectively dealing with licensing and ongoing issues that there was a vendor that was in a position to address these. We did put it out to competition, as I understand it, and this particular vendor was the only respondent. To my understanding, this was brought twice. Is that correct, Steve? I'm not sure. But we ended up that this was something that we had to address because of the needs of the agency, and we had run out of time to look for other ways to approach it immediately. As you said, one of the principal difficulties we face these days with a number of these issues is because we have built infrastructure that is reliant on either licensing or software from a particular vendor, we are locked into that until we change the system out completely.
Mr. Comptroller, we also have Jessica Metal, a Deputy Administrator of Support Services for MBA.
Yes.
For who?
For MBA.
MBA. Good morning. Afternoon, I think, now. How are you today? Yes, actually, this is for our IBR system at the MBA. This system, is where the customers, when they call, they get the responses for most everything that we do, which is the beeps, the notifications, and all of those things. We did advertise to all five of the master contractors. We did follow up with them repetitively to find out why they did not submit at this time. And they basically said that they could not be competitive because MS Technologies is both the manufacturer as well as master contractor as well as the manufacturer. Therefore, they weren't competitive. We've reached out again to NEC, and NEC said that they wouldn't be able to do it because it's not in their wheelhouse to do it because it's their system.
In effect, the software is controlled by the manufacturer, so it's very difficult for folks that don't have access to those licenses on a competitive basis themselves to be able to bid on these in a way that is competitive with the manufacturer.
And this is strictly for maintenance and any kind of patches or upgrades that we get periodically throughout the month, and we get many of them. It's not to replace the system, not just to maintain it.
Okay, so you're going to keep an eye on that. I have one final question, not about you, but about
thank you,
Mr. Secretary. But this is IT. What item is this? It's my favorite company, Motorola. I don't know whether anybody recalls over the last 14 years my objections to requiring our public safety people to...
Bill Parham, director of MDOT.
Yes, thank you.
Which number?
This is
we're talking about item 2.1 on item 40, Motorola Solutions. Radio Communications Master Contract.
Good morning. I'm William Parham, Acting Director of Procurement at MDOT MTA. These are our PORFs. They are, we reached out to all of the contractors that were qualified on the master contract. Basically, these PORFs are for the 700 megahertz migration of Maryland First system. One for the Metro, one for our light rail system. In both cases, we were told by the other vendors that they could not compete or they would not be authorized by Motorola to utilize their product. So in both cases, Motorola basically was the only qualified vendor.
Okay, so two questions.
This, yes, sir.
This isn't surprising to me. This is what I said was going to happen over this, but how much participation has there been by the local entities in this program?
Well, we seem to run into this issue often on this particular master contract where the other vendors do not submit their bids because of Motorola dominance of that material.
I take it the locals, or are we paying all of these costs? I take it the locals have to get charged for part of this. Right? The folks that
would have to do with the master contract.
Okay, well, let me ask a follow-up question. How much do these, in item 2.2, you're spending $400,000 approximately on 65 mobile radios. How much is that per radio? I'm not very good at math. That's a joke. Okay.
I would have to pull out
whatever
my phone, sir.
Yeah.
Write that down.
Yeah. Anyway, 400,000 ballpark divided by 65 is someone smarter than I. $6,000 per radio. I mean, do you think that's fair? Or is that just monopoly?
I would not be able to comment on whether the cost of the radio is fair, sir. When we utilize the PORF, we work with the master contractor or the master contract and the vendors that are qualified to provide those radios and consoles, and we get their bids.
Well, obviously it's in the public safety area, and we're all in favor of public safety, but I just want to offer that. And if you could get back to me or someone could get back to me as to what the cost of these radios are
how they are impeding or not impeding participation by local public safety entities. Please.
Yes, sir.
Thank you. Any other questions? DGS? Yes,
I have, I don't know if it's a question or comment, Mike, on the last
please.
That you explained well, I think. But looking at it, what we got,
yes.
It came at the last minute. It's one page. It's $250 million.
Absolutely.
Perhaps. If you could have said in the description attached to the item what you told us this morning, it would have been would have been very helpful.
Well, I will make sure that happens in the future.
Would be helpful. And I want to thank the comptroller for his proposal some time ago to include the task orders. I think it's extremely helpful. Good move. Thanks.
Thank you both.
All right. Any other questions?
Move approval.
Second. 3-0. That concludes it. Thank you.